Welcome back to Homegrown. This is Bob Hill.
And Janine Wishy. And today on the show, native fruits.
I love it. Two really interesting subjects, again, that I don't know nothing about.
Oh, you know something about
them.
Well,
I've ate them.
Yeah.
I've ate these fruits, but I didn't know anything about raisin or the propagating.
Yeah. We're going to talk about pawpaws and persimmons.
Yep.
And actually, the pawpaw tree that I've eaten most of the fruit from is the pawpaw tree that you have.
Absolutely. And every year it bears fruit, and they're on their way now to like almost 1 pound status.
Yeah.
And if I can beat the squirrels and the raccoons to them, I'll get a pawpaw.
Yeah, and our friend Bruce Efselage, who's in southern Indiana, has got a whole bunch in his on his property, and we'll collect buckets from him as well. And it's funny, when you eat them, you really do feel like a little animal. Do you know what I mean? Because you hold them and you kind of like... And you're chewing on this really soft, exotic fruit.
There's got to be a word, like, not onomatopoeia, there's got to be a word for imitating food as you eat it, the sound of there.
Yeah, and look like a little mouse or a little
I clearly
squirrel.
Don't know.
Yeah, exactly. That's okay. But yeah, we're going to talk to Dr. Kirk Pomper. He is at Kentucky State University, and he's heading up the pawpaw research these days. I think the research started over 15 years ago. And continue, so I'm sure they found out some really interesting things.
It's huge. I had no idea. Yeah. There are 1,500 different trees from 16 states and 8 acres of pawpaws.
Mm-hmm.
That in itself would be a sight to see.
And probably the interest in pawpaws has increased just in the last couple of years with the tobacco buyout and farmers, you know, pulling away from tobacco and looking to diversify the stuff that they grow, because that's one of the reasons they decided to do the research to make it more of a viable fruit crop, you know.
Exactly.
So anyway,
but before we get into the pawpaw, the other pea native plant, persimmons, a man named Don Compton, we'll talk to him. He showed up at Hidden Hill a couple months ago. He just wandered in, had a bright orange hat on there.
Yeah.
Said
a
Hobo
persimmon hat.
No, it said Hobo Ridge, I think it was.
Uh-huh.
And you're going to talk to anybody with a hat named Hobo Ridge.
Exactly.
And we did. And he's a really interesting man. His background was not in persimmons, but whose is?
Yeah, exactly.
And he talked about all of a sudden that he hybridizes them at the farm he and his wife live on, and had done a lot of work with it. Hasn't gotten to the marketing phase yet, but he knows a great deal about persimmons.
Yeah.
We're going to find out.
I love persimmons, so I'm really looking forward to this.
Exactly.
And you know how I was so worried about our Ukrainian persimmon that we bought because it was so slow to break dormancy in the spring. And it's put on, even with the drought, but of course we've watered it, it's put on like a foot of new growth.
Have you been persimmoned yet?
Not yet.
No persimmon yet.
No persimmon. Not on that tree, at least. But my other two persimmons are looking real good. Looking real good. But they're just not quite ripe yet.
How about the rest of your garden? What's happening out there?
Well, I'm collecting seeds, Bob.
Ooh. I heard them jiggle in your pocket,
yeah.
I thought. A clatter
still,
in your pocket.
Most of them, except my arugula, most of them are still on the plant. I'm doing the patient approach and letting things flower and go to seed. And then I'll collect the seeds. And primarily in the kitchen garden because of the lettuces. And arugula dries so nicely, and I've replanted that. That'll, you know, sprout up in the heat. But then the rest of the greens, they're just at the end of their flowering stage, and then I'm going to just leave them there until the seeds dry, collect the seeds, and then it'll be time to replant again. Isn't that cool?
That is cool. But are the natural critters, the birds and the other creatures, do they get those seeds too, or they just sit there?
They probably get some of them, but there's so many.
Plenty
to go around. You know what I mean? Like, and one little arugula seed pod has like 25 different seeds in it, it seems. I mean, there's tons of seeds.
See, I thought arugula was an island in the Mediterranean.
Yeah, I'm sure you did.
I had no idea you could eat
it.
It's
a spicy green that you probably wouldn't like anyway. So.
Okay.
And then also the zinnias. I'm letting, you know, we talk about deadheading and stuff like that, and how it's important to keep, you know, your plants on blooming, you know, throughout the season. But with a lot of annuals, I want to leave some to go back to seed so I can collect the seed and plant the annuals again.
Will they revert to something else?
They shouldn't. Okay. They shouldn't. So, I mean, because these were basically like old-fashioned zinnias anyway. If you get some fancy hybrid seed, that they may. But so what? Could be something pretty cool.
And actually, I do have one plant, the old dollar plant? Money plant.
The
money plant. That's got those round brown silver dollar things. And we've started to save those from year to year. I like the plant. It turns off kind of a dirty brown by late to midsummer, but
pretty
it's got
cool.
a nice transition to it, a nice history to it.
Yeah. So, yeah, don't deadhead everything. And it's also, too, I just think, an interesting thing to follow and to watch as these plants start to change and bolt and flower and then die. And then you have all this seed available to you, and you don't have to go out and buy it.
And actually, I once had a persimmon tree on my property. I used to watch it closely, mm-hmm. but it died.
Did it die,
so
too?
So I've got to find out what happened.
Well, I'll save you some of my persimmon seeds, okay. and we'll see if you can get a persimmon started from seed, too.
Meanwhile, we've got a guest here who can straighten us up on this persimmon Good. Situation, you know, so to speak.
So to speak.
His name's Don Compton, who, along with his wife, Norma, have been involved in growing, selecting, and hybridizing persimmons for almost 15 years in his farm near Marengo, Indiana. He comes by this chancy occupation naturally. One of his former jobs was as a dealer at Caesar's Riverboat in Indiana. Don, welcome to Homegrown.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Now, you grew up on the farm. I'm always curious about personal history. You grew up on the farm in southern Indiana. Kind of walk us through from there until the persimmon light came on.
Well, after serving a tour in the service and working maintenance most of my life, I became a dealer at the boat. Belonged to a number of nut growing organizations. I'm on the board of directors of the Kentucky Nut Growers. I read an article some years ago that was written by Mr. James Claypool about breeding persimmons, and I figured I could do that myself, and so for about the last 15 years, that's what I've been doing.
But why persimmons? What made the light come on for that particular crop?
I've always liked persimmons.
When I seen, grow what you like.
Yeah. That's right. And once I seen that there was something better out there than just the old wild varieties, I took a bigger interest in it.
Mm-hmm. So are persimmons often categorized under like the nut growing organizations, because it is a little different? Do you know
a
what
lot
I mean?
Of the
you
nut...
get to find somewhere to stick it.
A lot of the nut growers take and are interested in other things: pawpaws, persimmons, a lot of the minor fruits.
Mm-hmm. So, is the persimmon considered a minor fruit?
I don't consider it a minor.
I wouldn't consider it a minor fruit either.
Love those persimmon backers. Well, let's talk about, in general, a persimmon, where you find it growing naturally, what it looks like, because some of our listeners probably have never seen or eaten one.
Well, the persimmon is one of the first one to colonize an abandoned pasture. They're a member of the ebony family. They're very hardy. They're easy to grow. They're easy to graft. They make great pastries and ice creams. When you're doing a monoculture with them, planting them in orchards, you have two major pests. You have the persimmon borer, which you have to spray for down low to the ground, and the girdling beetle, which is just obnoxious. You just pick up the limbs and burn those.
And the wood is real hard. I know there were persimmon golf clubs of yore. I remember reading about those and actually breaking one or two, I think.
It was used for a lot of tools, wooden tools. It's very close-grained, very hard, very dense. And I don't think it's much used anymore, though.
And it's native to this area and other parts of the country. Have you any idea where?
It's native basically to the whole eastern end of the United States. And there's basically two species. We have a 60-chromosome variety south of the Ohio River and a 90-chromosome variety north.
So they can read. They know what they're not wanted.
Right. Well, this all goes back to the glacial period when it was separated.
Well, tell us about that. Sounds interesting.
Well, back when the glacier or the ice age period was ending, there was a mass extinction, and a lot of our native plants lost their pollinators and their seed distributors. And the glacier wiped out everything north of the Ohio River. It actually farmed the Ohio River when it melted. And for some reason, when this plant crossed over, it became a 90-chromosome variety. Hmm. Now, the seed distributors are basically the foxes and the raccoons. Hmm. And because they don't carry the seeds far enough through the environment, we suffer from inbred depression.
Okay.
And this is the major problem we have with the wild persimmon.
So, Don, what's the consequences, I guess, of the genetic pool, so to speak, not being big enough?
Well, there's a lot of things. If the plant is not able to express itself any better, it becomes stunted, sickly, just doesn't perform well at all. But it can also cause genetic mutations, and these are the things that I like to work with.
Right, sometimes that's advantageous. Yeah. So is the American persimmon population threatened in any way?
No, but it's in a major change right now. We are finding what's known as polygamodioecious plants.
And can you need to explain that for our listeners.
This, a dioecious plant is either male or female. Mm-hmm. when it becomes polygamy, it tries to be both.
Mm-hmm. Uh-oh. So they're confused.
Yes.
Or we're confused, one or the other.
So when you use what appears to be a male flower on a female tree, all you get is female plants. And I have always thought that this was a dioecious plant that's trying to become monoecious.
Mm-hmm.
But this year we had fruiting males appear in the orchard, and this is a whole new ball game now because the fruit on these trees are completely different from the normal persimmons.
Okay, let's back you up to 1991 then. You read this book, and as far as you know, nobody else in the country was doing working with persimmons very much. And where did you go from this article that fired you up to do this?
Well, I got a hold of Mr. Claypool and talked with him on numerous occasions.
Where does he live?
He lives in St. Elmo in Illinois.
Okay. But you set out to do what? What was your goal when you started in 91?
Well, just to improve the varieties of persimmons.
Eventually for more commercial use and product and so forth.
For whatever I could find that they could do.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So how has, over the years, have you found that people are more familiar with persimmons? Are they more interested even in just, purchasing the trees? For ornamental purposes, fruiting purposes.
The older generation still remembers them and likes to eat them. Mm-hmm. The younger generations are basically... Don't know what they are.
Yeah.
Yes. We're going to have to re-educate everybody. We're going to have to put in some orchards and create some commercial products to sell.
Mm-hmm.
And this comes into the USDA. They have changed the rules this year, and it's making it much harder now to market a persimmon product.
How come?
The persimmon can't fall off the tree. It has to be picked from the tree.
Oh, my gosh. No gravity involved here.
No. Any product has to be done in a commercial kitchen. It has to be pasteurized.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just the day of the little guy going out and making pulp and selling it along the road has ended.
So what are some of the processing of persimmons? What are some of the better ways to actually prepare it? Because they're relatively, especially if people aren't familiar with the persimmon, beautiful colored fruit and not a very long shelf life. So that's one of the challenges with turning it into product. So, essentially you can't really sell them as a fresh fruit product, but processing is...
You would have, if you're going to sell them as a fresh product, it would have to be done...
Straight away,
quick.
Mm-hmm.
When you pasteurize, say, the pulp, you've destroyed its value at that point. Pastries, flavorings for ice cream, as I mentioned before, is probably... looking at a way right now is to actually produce a persimmon pudding in a jar with a long shelf life that could be purchased through a grocery store.
So processing is a big issue
in
terms of getting it marketed.
Right.
Now, you've got a couple hundred trees on your property. How have you helped the tree evolve? What do you have now from where you started with? What's your best product, I guess, is what I'm asking you.
Well, a lot of our polygamma dioecious crosses are really looking good. We have a lot more that will be coming into bearing in the next few years. And these, we know, are going to all be females, so it's just going to be a matter of evaluating them and then start running more crosses against them.
Mm-hmm. So if people are interested in growing persimmons, what are some of the basics that they should understand about care and cultivation of persimmons?
Nothing more than you would use for any ornamental tree in the yard. You just plant it and make sure it stays watered, and you'd have to watch out for the persimmon borer because they will kill the tree.
Mm-hmm. So just that one thing.
The one thing.
And how big will they get? What's their ultimate height and weight and fighting
actually,
weight?
Actually, there's a lot of genetics involved in that. There's some of them that are timber type, which the fruit are basically unedible. They hang on the tree till February, and when they do fall, it just leaves an oil slick on the ground. Possums won't even eat it. Yeah. And usually this is more of the bluer varieties, but we do have some good edible blue varieties. Pound's Blue is one cultivar that is very good.
We recently purchased a Ukrainian persimmon and are looking forward to seeing how that compares to some of the hybrids that we also have at the farm.
Are you talking about Rossiyanka?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And I'm curious, with the stuff that you're working on, are you strictly hybridizing American persimmons?
At this point, yes, but I have some Dispyros khaki variety sylvestris, which is the wild variety of the Oriental persimmon. The Russians actually crossed the Dispyros khaki and the Dispyros virginiana. This is the Rossiyanka, Nikita's gift.
Right, and that's what we got.
Yes. And I'm wanting to work these into my breeding program also.
Because explain what the value is, I suppose, of crossbreeding these different species.
Well, in theory, you should get the best qualities of both sides.
Which are?
Size for the Dispyros khaki, hardiness of the
American
Dispyros virginiana.
Okay.
See, the Dispyros khaki will not live here. Mm-hmm. It's cold tender.
And that may be the one that most people, ironically enough, are more familiar with.
That's true.
Because that particular persimmon is larger. It's a firmer fleshed fruit. So it has a longer shelf life. And if you ever see persimmons in the grocery store, that's the one that you see. So if we can get the longer shelf life, the size of the Asian varieties mixed with our American, then we should have a tree that would maybe do a little bit better in terms of fresh fruit.
Well, see, the Asians have been working with this tree for over 1,000 years. And I'm seeing some of the traits that could lead to something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a long ways down the road.
Process, yeah.
Well, Don, are you envisioning the Don Compton, you pick 'em persimmon farm? Where's this going?
In the next year or so, I plan on opening the farm to a U-pick. I plan on putting in a small test orchard to see, you know, if there's any interest in it. That way I can beat all the USDA regulations concerning handling the fruit. I'm not liable if
somebody else picks it off the ground.
And this will be, what seasons are they usually ripen in? What's the window of opportunity here?
Well, with my varieties, they start about the third week of August, and if you interplant some of the old-fashioned varieties, you can run that's pretty close into November.
Mm-hmm. And you're near Marengo, Indiana, right?
Just 5 miles north of Marengo, Indiana.
Okay.
And I have to ask the ultimate persimmon question, Don. Many people have heard of or experienced the most dreadful taste experience if you bite into a persimmon that is not quite ready, that's not completely ripe. How do you tell if a persimmon's ripe, short of it falling off the tree?
Well, on my varieties, if you just lightly tap the fruit, it'll fall off in your hand, and you can press on it. It should be a little soft, and then you can eat it.
Mm-hmm. Well, Don, thanks for coming in, and we wish you well, and stay in touch with us, and we'll let the world know next year when your persimmon farm is open for picking.
Thank you very much.
Great deal.
Thanks, Don.
Don Compton, along with his wife, Norma, have been involved in growing, selecting, and soon to be selling persimmons near their farm at Marengo, Indiana. For more information on Don, his farm, or persimmons, visit the homegrown page at WFPL.org.
Coming up next, Dr. Kurt Pomper and the Fruit and Nut Development Laboratory of Kentucky State University. Pawpaws have been their primary subject for over 15 years, and we take a look at what they found out thus far. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL and Kentucky Public Radio. Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
And I'm Bob Hill, ready to move on from persimmons to pawpaws.
Persimmons to pawpaws, indeed. Honestly, if you've never heard of them, which could be the case
for
some people.
Well, the pawpaw patch, there's an old song about that.
Yeah, but if you're young, you've never heard it.
Maybe they could rap to the pawpaw patch.
Maybe.
There ought to be a pawpaw rap song.
There could be. You could work on that
this
weekend.
Let's cut one.
Okay.
Homegrown does a rap on pawpaws.
Both are just great native fruits that I think a lot of people don't know about.
But should.
So we're trying to inform you.
Yes, we are.
And we have Kurt Pomper that can explain in more detail, I guess, how cool the pawpaw really is, Bob, because Kurt is the director of Kentucky State University's Pawpaw Program. He's been there since 1998. Actually, the program started back in 1990 in order to develop a comprehensive program that would help the pawpaws be a little more viable, basically, as a commercial fruit crop in the Southeast and also in the state of Kentucky. Today, the program has diversified a bit. It now includes gooseberries, currants, persimmons, and grapes, table grapes, as well as wine grapes. But of course, the pawpaw still rules. It's still king with this program, and Kurt Pomper's on the line. He's joining us from Kentucky State University to talk about it. Kurt, welcome to Homegrown, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Sure. Why did the program originally target the pawpaw for the research farm?
Well, there's been an interest in pawpaw here since about 1990, and there was a person here at K-State named Calloway who became interested in pawpaw just by encountering it. He was living in the southeast and thought that it merited further investigation. And basically in the late 80s, there had been a resurgence of pawpaw interest across the country, especially across the southeast where it's a native plant.
Yeah.
And so it kind of tied into that. And so Kentucky State University helped support further research in pawpaw. And since that time, a couple other people have led the program. Brett Calloway was the first, and then Desmond Lane, and now myself since 1998. Mm-hmm.
So what were the initial goals? I mean, just to figure out what, to prove what?
Well, basically, here we have a multi-faceted program with a lot of different things that we'd like to know about pawpaw. Mm-hmm. And since we're the only full-time research program in pawpaw, we end up doing a lot of different things to try and answer folks' questions about what to grow and how to propagate pawpaw and how to harvest the fruit and store it. So we do a lot of different things. And I guess basically if you go back, way back to interest in pawpaw, back around 1916, mm-hmm. there was actually a contest supported by the American Genetics Association, which was to find the best pawpaw.
Mm-hmm.
And there actually was a contest with many entries, and there were a number of really good fruit varieties that were identified. And you would have thought the pawpaw would have caught on after that, but it just didn't. And one of the reasons for that is that the pawpaw is highly perishable. And of course, there wasn't refrigeration back in the early part of around 1910, 1915. Mm-hmm. So it's likely the reason the pawpaw didn't catch on as quickly as, say, blueberry, which was also coming about that time, is because of the perishability of the fruit.
Mm-hmm.
But about 1980, as I said, there was a resurgence in pawpaw, and many enthusiasts out there and members of various organizations such as the Northern Nut Growers and North American Fruit Explorers began to look into pawpaw and publicize it and select some pretty good varieties from the wild and propagate those. And that kind of, I think, led to that interest in developing more information here at K-State with those varieties.
Well, Kirk, let me back you up a little further than that, because it's a wonderfully archaic-looking plant and fruit to me. Does the pawpaw go back thousands of years, and is it native to other places besides in the southeast United States?
It's actually in the same family as the Annonaceae family, so it's actually related to Cherimoya and soursop. But the pawpaw that we talk about is a Simona triloba, and it's actually native only here in North America. And it's the only truly temperate species. There's actually it's the only member of the temperate genus, Simona, that extends this far up into the northern part of North America.
Mm-hmm.
And it's sometimes referred to as the pawpaw that folks confuse with the papaya. Papaya
mm-hmm.
is also often referred to as pawpaw, and so there's some confusion on that. But it's not related to papaya at all. But actually, DeSoto, when touring around in the southeastern part of the United States, did report in a journal back, I think it was around 15-something, that pawpaw was being eaten by Native Americans.
Mm-hmm.
And Lewis and Clark actually wrote in their journal that they helped use pawpaws to further their rations back when they were coming back on their trip from out west. And other people, such as... Daniel Boone was supposedly a pawpaw fan. There's a lot of history back there with the pawpaw.
It's a great fruit.
Yeah.
Is there any good excuse for the name pawpaw? You get a name once, you say it twice, you like it so much, or where did that come from? You know?
That's a good question, and the origin of the word is actually unknown. It's likely from a Native American origin. The convention has been to have it be one word, pawpaw, and a few years back it used to be pawpaw as two words, and some...
Right.
Some state or some cities in some states actually do have it spelled that way yet. And even in some old literature, you'll find it as pawpaw.
Oh, huh. Yeah.
So how do you refer to it as one word, pawpaw?
Yeah, that's what we've been using that convention since about 1980.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, we'll stick with that one then,
right.
Okay?
Sure.
Right.
So let's cover some of the characteristics of the tree and then talk about the fruit in a little more detail. as a landscape tree, for example, Kirk, is it a good choice for a regular backyard?
Yeah, I think it's an excellent choice. It's a kind of a medium-sized tree. It's not extremely vigorous, but fairly vigorous. There's some good grafted varieties, just like, I guess in this audience we don't have to describe what a cultivar is, but mm-hmm. there are named varieties of pawpaw that have been selected and then propagated from budding onto seedling rootstock. And so there are some very good superior varieties out there that can be grown in your backyard. And it has kind of an interesting form, kind of a large leaf, drooping leaf, kind of tropical-like, mm-hmm. and has a very interesting flavor, kind of a pineapple, mango, banana flavor, sometimes a little more mango, and sometimes with a bit of melon aftertaste. Mm-hmm. And so it makes a really great addition and a unique component in an edible landscape.
But it takes two to pawpaw, right? You need a male and a female, or two pawpaw trees, or what do you need?
It does take two trees. The flowers both have male and female parts, but okay. they are self-incompatible, so you need a genetically different tree to be able to have fruit set. Yep, exactly.
I've got one in my backyard that blooms heavily every year, and I don't know where the other pawpaw is, but I think it's like half a mile away. Is that possible that they come that far?
It's possible, and that's some of the things we work on in terms of research is we're looking at the pollination biology right now because we're trying to understand that flies and beetles are the main pollinators, and we really think that some cultivars, some of these varieties may be self-fertile too, self-fruitful. It's interesting. Some of the folks, you'll talk about the older folks who had pawpaw patches out in their woods, they'll talk about never having any fruit in their patches.
Right.
Some would hang roadkill out in their patches to try and bring in more
flies.
Wow.
But, that's crazy.
You know, if you have a lot of flies, it's probably fine.
Uh-huh.
And a lot of times people say they never have pawpaws in their patches, and there's a number of reasons. It is a native understory tree, so if you don't have a lot of sunlight getting into your patch, you won't have a lot of fruit set. You may have a lack of pollinators if you have a number of flies around for fruit set. And
mm-hmm.
oftentimes you'll find patches that might be 500 trees or stems large, and it's all coming from one original tree because they do sucker from the roots. So if you're a homeowner, that's something to consider. You may have root suckers you're going to have to cut back from your tree.
Is that one of the improvements, though? I mean, in terms of get the named cultivars and the selections, trying to eliminate the suckering, or not necessarily?
We're trying to look at various selection of seedling rootstocks right now, and lack of suckering is something we're looking for, in rootstock development here at K-State.
Mm-hmm. We were recently at the Kentucky State Fair, Kirk, and I was checking out the pawpaws there and noticing the different sizes of fruit. Most of these have been harvested, and they weren't quite ripe yet.
Yeah.
But, that's because the fair is too early for pawpaws. But different sizes of fruit. So is it fair to say that some of the smaller fruit was from native stands, perhaps, and some of the larger fruit maybe from a cultivated variety, or not necessarily?
It's pretty likely. You know, I guess many folks who have selected these have selected for the large fruit size. The rule of thumb is if you see a fruit on a wild tree that's very cylindrical, it probably means it has quite a bit of seed in it compared to a ratio of pulp. And if you're looking for a round fruit, that's oftentimes what the cultivars are going to have because it's going to be a better pulp seed ratio.
Mm-hmm.
And there are some really good varieties out there. And here at K-State, we've done a lot of work with propagation and also rootstock trials of variety selection and variety trials. And some very good varieties of pawpaw for Kentucky.
Mm-hmm.
If anybody wants to grab a pencil out there, Overlease, which is originally selected in Indiana, is a really good variety. It has kind of an interesting melon aftertaste, so some people really like that and some people don't.
Mm-hmm.
Overlease, and then Sunflower is another one that was selected originally in Kansas. It's a good one. And NC1, and it's kind of a strange name, NC-1, is another good one. It was actually originally selected in southern Ontario and has a great flavor, and it's actually scored the highest in our tasting trials here at Kentucky State University in the last few years. So those are three really good ones that I can recommend, and there are some other patented varieties that have come out of Neil Peterson's pawpaw breeding program. He's a private breeder. Shenandoah and Susquehanna, which are really good too.
Okay. How does the pawpaw rank as like an orchard tree? Do you know what I mean? Like, if I was growing a handful of them or a dozen of them and then trying to take them to market, is that something that we're getting closer to being a viable, you know, pursuit, or is it still problematic because of the perishable issue of the fruit?
It's a concern, and perishability is something we've worked on for a while in collaboration with the University of Kentucky also, with folks there. The shelf life of a pawpaw at room temperature is about a week, and then it'll overripe, and just like a banana, basically, it'll caramelize and become overripe. If you pick how we tell a pawpaw is ripe is actually by feeling it. Some will have a bit of a color break, turn a little yellow when they're ripe, but it's not a reliable indicator. So basically, you want to harvest when they're starting to soften, and they can be stored at refrigeration, under refrigeration for maybe up to 3 weeks.
Well, that's not too bad.
Yeah. And they do tend to bruise a little, so we're working on packaging, too. That's another problem that we have to address, is that we want to pick them while they're still, you know, not firm, but just starting to soften. If you pick a pawpaw too hard, it'll never actually complete that ripening cycle unless it's just starting to soften.
Is there any kind of commercial market out there yet, or how do you develop one if there's not?
Well, there's a lot of interest in pawpaw, especially in the gourmet market. A lot of chefs out there. For a while, the Silbach Hilton over here at the Oak Room Restaurant in Louisville have been carrying pawpaw dishes, and I know that Chef Gerhard at the Limestone Restaurant is interested in pawpaw, also has that on the menu when possible. And so there are restaurants out there, and there is an interest in there's an ice cream company, which I guess I can't name right now, who is trying to develop a pawpaw ice cream for sale here in Kentucky anyway, to restaurants. And so I'm hoping that's actually going to happen over the next couple of years. We only have a few small growers right now, and so we just have other folks who are planting, and hopefully we'll have more and more pawpaws available out there for sale, and that's kind of what's limiting the development of industries. We just need more and more growers.
How about the farmers' markets? Is that still available in those?
Yeah, you can usually oftentimes find pawpaws at the farmers' market. There's actually a person in the Lexington farmers' market who brings pawpaws each Saturday and sells them, named Roland McIntosh. And I know that folks have told me they've been up in Cincinnati and found them at farmers' markets up there. Mm-hmm. So it's something you can look for at your local farmers' market and possibly find.
So what's the best way to eat them? Just fresh?
I love eating them just fresh, just especially when you're out in the field. And
yeah, and you're hungry.
Yep, and it's sunny. And they're very aromatic, and so it really, if they're very warm and in the hot sun, there's a real great aroma as you sample that fruit. Mm-hmm. And you know, a lot of these, as I said, have kind of a mango, pineapple, banana flavor. Some of the wild pawpaws that people have tried maybe in the past and not liked, oftentimes those wild selections have kind of a bitter turpentine aftertaste, and the ones that have been selected by folks out there don't have that.
Okay, so don't let a previous experience of tasting one out in its native environment turn you off of trying some of the selections.
Exactly.
Yeah. Do you eat the skin and all?
Don't want to eat the skin. It's a little bitter. It's not bad for you or anything, but it's still bitter, and it wouldn't be an enjoyable experience. And the seeds are fairly large, and you would want to try and eat them anyway because they're fairly large. Mm-hmm. The pulp makes great ice cream. It can be used in souffles and custards. It can be made into a jam. It's a low pectin fruit, so it takes a lot of addition of sugar gel to be able to get it set up.
Mm-hmm. I like it as kind of an ornamental tree. I've got, like I said, one in my backyard, and I think as a conversation piece, you're trying to one-up your neighbor with some kind of interesting trees. A couple of pawpaws back there would be kind of fun to have. The leaves are nice, a little bit of yellow fall colors, I remember, and why not?
Mm-hmm. Yep, exactly.
Yep, squirrels like them too.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And, yeah, that is one thing. When they drop on the ground, we usually hand harvest, but if they drop on the ground, you know, you'll have, at least at the farm here, we'll have raccoons and possums try and sample them, but they'll never go up in the trees to actually get the fruit, has been my experience.
Mm-hmm, so they wait for them to drop.
Yep.
Availability of the named selections, are they pretty available?
They're fairly available. You know, a lot of the ones I named initially, Overlease, NC1, Sunflower, those are readily available. If you go to our website, and I guess I should plug the website at this point.
We'll provide a link to the website from our website as well.
That'd be great.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, it's www.pawpaw.kysu.edu.
Okay.
And there's actually a list of cultivars and then where you can buy each cultivar on that webpage.
Okay, great.
And so some of the, there's a couple of patented ones out there right now, Susquehanna and Shenandoah, and that, they're only sold by one person. But otherwise, there's actually a number of nurseries, even here in Kentucky, that sell varieties, such as Nolan River Nut Tree Nursery,
right.
That
right.
sells many of these pawpaws.
The Britons, yeah.
And my tree's about maybe 20, 25 feet tall, and just a nice little specimen, so the culture isn't difficult, is it? Just regular dirt?
No, it's pretty easy to grow.
Yeah.
And they tolerate a range of pH. We've had quite a bad drought here in Franklin County. We seem to, thunderstorms seem to go right around us and go to either side.
But, me too.
Yeah. But they do fare quite well in a range of soils. They actually do like to have moisture. So they're a tree that you may want to irrigate to make sure you get a good crop of fruit off of in your backyard too.
Mm-hmm.
And fertilization, about an ounce of nitrogen per year for the first several years, and then 2 ounces of nitrogen per year after that. Very little pruning, just basically removing lower limbs and diseased limbs in the tree.
What about the fact that they're in their native environment, traditionally understory trees? Are there concerns about, you know, planting them out in full sun, or, you know, when they're young, should they be protected, that sort of thing?
Right, that's a great point. And when you're purchasing a tree that's smaller than about a foot and a half tall, it likely is a good idea to use a tree shelter or use some type of black mesh webbing to provide some shading. Otherwise, if the tree is over a foot and a half tall, our experience has been, as long as you control the weeds,
mm-hmm.
and provide adequate moisture and fertilization, they'll do fine.
Okay.
And oftentimes we'll use a wood chip mulch. We found at the farm using a landscape fabric with straw on top is an excellent combination because it'll provide weed control and also help keep the moisture mm-hmm. in the soil around the trees.
Mm-hmm. So what's the outlook, after 15 years of looking at the pawpaws being a viable fruit crop, what's the outlook for the next 15 years?
I think we're right on the verge of it becoming a more available crop, and we have a number of folks who have over 300 trees planted here in Kentucky, and there's actually many plantings across the southeastern United States. So I think we're going to see more and more pawpaw available on the gourmet market over the next few years.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where it's going to go from there, it's hard to tell. We do have these issues of handling and perishability. But I think especially if we can develop a faster way of extracting the pulp. Right now we're basically using just hand methods and mesh screens to remove the pulp from the seed.
Mm-hmm.
And then we freeze that pulp. And we can actually save that pulp and freeze it for up to 2 years and have a good quality pulp to use.
Mm-hmm.
So I think a pulp market, a processing market, is where there's a lot of potential, but it's a matter of trying to find a commercial extraction process to be able to do that. That's
right.
We need to do.
Does that mean Pawpaw Wine's just down the road?
There's already Pawpaw Wine available. There's actually a White Owl Winery in Illinois has been producing Pawpaw Wine for several years, and they've done a great job on it.
Really?
Yeah, and I've had some really bad fruit wine.
Yeah, I bet you have.
They do a good job on the Pawpaw Wine. Yeah, there's a lot of potential, a lot of things you can do with Pawpaw.
Yeah, it sounds good. We just need to get more people to have had that taste experience of how tasty it really is and the fact that it's a native fruit, and I think that it probably will take off a bit. Kirk, thanks a lot for your time. We appreciate it.
Sure. Thank you very much.
Thank
sure.
You.
Dr. Kirk Pomper directs the Fruit and Nut Development Laboratory at Kentucky State University. Their primary research looks at the native pawpaw and improving its characteristics as a commercial fruit crop for Kentucky and the Southeast. If you'd like more information on Dr. Pomper's pawpaws, please visit our website at wfpl.org.
Coming up next, we have listeners' questions and a new Latin word of the week. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL and Kentucky Public Radio. Welcome back to Homegrown. This is Bob Hill.
And Janine Wishy.
And we have a caller on the line.
We do indeed, for questions.
Yes.
Michelle from New Albany. What's your question, Michelle?
My question is, I have a rose bush that I transplanted from my mother's house.
Mm-hmm.
It had stopped producing roses. It had gone, I believe it might have gone wild, and she had cut it back.
Mm-hmm.
And so I transplanted it in hopes that I could possibly get the roses to come back. And after I transplanted it, I fertilized it with very old rabbit manure
mm-hmm.
that someone had given me. It was almost like a powdery substance. And since then, I believe it has It looks like it might have a fungus or something.
And are you curious as to whether the rabbit manure might cause that?
Yes, because it looks like it helped my vegetables. My vegetables are doing great since I put that on there. But this rose bush, I don't know if it's coincidence.
Whether or not you used rabbit manure or nothing or traditional fertilizer, your rose likely would still have what appears to be fungus.
Okay.
Is this rose like a hybrid tea rose likely? Do you see a bud union, like a knot at the base of it?
Yes.
A smaller plant?
There is a knot. It looks like it was like a chunk of wood.
Okay, so it's a smaller plant. It's not like one of the large shrub roses or ramblers, like a more old-fashioned rose. The hybrid teas and grandifloras, Michelle, are real susceptible to fungal problems and also like insect problems. Okay. In order to keep hybrid teas and grandifloras clean, you got to spray them like every 10 to 14 days.
Okay.
Which that's why I think roses are not that appealing to a lot of people because they're so high maintenance. Yeah. There are other types of roses that are more disease resistant these days that you can choose from. Okay. So a lot of people are going that way. But if you really want to keep them clean, you have to do that. And you're kind of consternated over the fact that they haven't bloomed, like they didn't bloom in your mom's yard before you transplanted them.
No, they were doing great for a while, mm-hmm. and then something happened. And since it was at her house, I'm not sure what it was.
Well, did the environment change in any way? Like it became shadier because of other trees growing around it?
That could have happened.
Okay, because roses need full sun. And they're not going to bloom very well if they don't have full sun. They also like it kind of on the hot side. I mean, they like adequate moisture, but they like it, you know, warmer in the summer.
Yeah.
So when did you transplant it?
This spring.
This spring.
And it's done well. You know, it seemed to have a little bit of a shock at first.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as the leaves and the growth, it has new growth.
Okay.
And it's looking great.
But no buds.
No buds.
Okay, well, let it kind of, since you transplanted it this spring, let it establish itself. Trim it up a little bit. After it gets cold, don't trim it up yet. Like, wait till, usually I wait till after Thanksgiving to start cutting on roses.
Okay.
Trim it up a little bit, and then you can mulch around the base of it to protect the base. Like 10 inches to 8 to 10 inches of mulch to protect that bud union that we're talking about, that knot.
Yes.
And then in the spring of the year, usually in March, you can start, you know, as it starts to warm up, you can remove that mulch and let the plant, you know, come alive again. And then you can prune it a little bit more to shape it up, get rid of anything that had died back.
Okay.
And then see what happens. That's also that March time is a good time to fertilize the rose, like with nitroform, something like that, a high nitrogen earlier in the season to give it a boost. Okay.
Okay. Wonderful.
Okay. That's, I mean, roses can be tricky.
Yeah.
I mean, it should bloom for you once, if it's in full sun, it should bloom for you. Once it's established, and if not, I really don't know what the problem would be. I mean, even if it looked kind of ratty, it should still give you a couple of blooms, you know? So.
Well, thank you.
No problem.
Yeah, thank you.
And good luck with it, okay?
Okay, thanks.
Uh-huh.
Goodbye.
Bye. All right, Bob, we have another question. This one is from Paul, and he writes from Hikes Point in the Louisville area,
wow,
of course.
A long way.
Dear Bob and Janine, I just purchased some bare root peonies, but I'm not certain about how to go about planting them. I know there's an issue with planting depth. Please advise. He's straight to the point.
Yeah, I'll talk about the transplanting part, and you can take planting the new ones. One of the sins of gardening is to transplant a peony too deeply,
mm-hmm.
and it just won't bloom again.
Mm-hmm.
You hear that over and over and over again. That's true. Whatever depth it was before, be absolutely sure it's the same.
Well, not necessarily, because if it was at too deep a depth before, then you're going to.
Well, it never would have bloomed. They would have never known it.
That's true. That's true. So. But a lot of times people transplant peonies because they're not blooming.
Right.
So it could be like not enough sun anymore because the environment's changed, or that the plant is planting too deep because there absolutely is a planting depth issue. And when we get bare root peonies, Bob,
mm-hmm.
They look kind of weird because like this tuberous sort of thing.
Talk about an ugly duckling becoming a swan.
Yeah.
It's the roots of a peony.
Exactly. So what you want to do is you want to locate the eyes that you'll see on those roots. So they're going to be little pointy, kind of whitish, pinkish buds, basically. Those you want situated at the top.
Right.
Because you can't always tell exactly with bare root peonies, like which way the roots are supposed to go, you know?
Yeah.
So locate those eyes. That's going to be at the top of the plant. You want a full sun location, and you want good drainage. So dig a hole that's, you know, big, you know, two or three times bigger than what you've got, but just make sure that you've got good drainage. The key is those eyes, don't plant those more than 2 inches beneath the soil surface, because it's all about chilling. Those buds need to be chilled sufficiently in the wintertime in order to set buds that would become flowers. So peonies that are planted too deep or over mulched, even, Bob,
yep,
they will not bloom because the buds haven't been chilled. And I think a lot of people forget, it's like even with, you know, we sometimes wonder why our cherry trees don't bloom well, even if we've had like a good spring, mm-hmm, or certain other flowering plants. We forget that this chilling period in the wintertime is really important for certain flowering plants.
It's mandatory.
And peonies are one. A lot of our flowering fruit trees, ornamentals, are another. So that chilling period over the wintertime is necessary.
Yeah, and don't expect a great show of peonies the first year, because mm-hmm, you just don't get them. You get a couple stalks and a flower. You wonder what the excitement's all about. But boy, you wait 2 or 3 years, mm-hmm, you'll be excited.
Yeah, because sometimes they do need that adjustment period.
Right.
So there you have it. Just make sure you have those eyes on the top side,
right,
and not too deep.
The eyes have it.
Peonies, the eyes do indeed have it.
If you have a question for Bob or Janine, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org or email us at homegrown@WFPL.org or call us at 502-814-8246. Well, Miss Wishy, this Latin word of the week, you stumped me. I've never heard of this one. I've never heard it used. I mean, explained, I guess, is a better way of saying it.
Yeah.
I'm such a great speaker, but I've never heard it explained properly. This, one's good.
This one's good. Good. I'm glad you think so. The Latin word of the week this week is lept.
Like left-handed?
Sort of.
L-E-P-T.
L-E-P-T.
Okay.
Lept.
Okay.
And it's Greek, and in compound words, it's used to signify slender. So you're always going to see it in, you know, some sort of compound use.
Okay.
So, for example, Leptospermum.
Right.
It's a genus. Leptospermum, it's a tea tree. So there's different species of tea trees. Leptospermum, slender seed. Spermum, leptospermum.
Lepto.
Slender seed. Leptodermis.
Thin skinned. There you go.
So slender skinned, essentially. And this usually refers to the a real thin membrane that's over the calyx. You know, that little part that kind of holds the bloom, you know.
That's cool.
Leptocallus. What's callus mean?
What's the
stem? Thin stem. So for example,
the Christmas cactus.
A Opuntia.
Perfect example.
I think
example.
That's how you say it. Opuntia. Yeah. Opuntia. Yeah. Opuntia leptocallus.
And think of the
Christmas cactus.
The small stems between those fat little
Exactly.
That's the thin part.
That is the thin part.
Wow.
Very good, Bob.
Merry Christmas, Bob.
Leptophyllus.
Thin skin leaves.
Thin leaves.
Thin leaves, yeah. Sorry.
Thin leaves.
Yeah.
Ipomoea leptophylla.
The pink morning glory.
The pink blooming one is, you'll notice that the leaves are a little different.
They have very thin leaves. Because
you
can see the sun through.
You can.
Yeah.
Bob, it's like you should have seen his face.
The
it's
little
sort of
lights
all of a sudden made
here. Whoa.
Sense to him.
I like this show. I'm going to stick around and do it some more.
Salvia leptophylla.
The slender leaf sage.
Slender leaf sage.
There you go.
And then leptotes.
Yeah.
It means some delicateness.
Like me.
Just like you, Bob.
I say I'm leptodes all the time.
Leptodes,
right toadies.
So if you see lept, L-E-P-T, in a compound word, it's going to mean whatever that is, it's slender or thin.
So people who are leptomaniacs steal a lot of thin money.
Maybe.
Yeah, okay. I'm just
are they like thin things or thin women
fingers.
Or thin men?
Thin, yeah. I'm trying to help people out here.
That ends another edition of Homegrown. And remember, you can learn more about any of the topics we talked about today by visiting our website at WFPL.org.
Homegrown is produced by Brad Yost in the studios of WFPL. Our website is maintained by Alice Thompson. I'm Bob Hill.
And I'm Janine Wishy. Join us next week for Homegrown on WFPL and Kentucky Public Radio.